You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is Dr. A.J. Swoboda. A.J. is a professor, author, and pastor of Theophilus in urban Portland, Oregon. He teaches theology, biblical studies, and Christian history at George Fox Evangelical and Fuller Seminaries. He's the founder and director of Blessed Earth Northwest, a center that helps think creatively and strategically around creation care issues in the Pacific Northwest. His newest book is The Dusty Ones, Why Wandering Deepens Your Faith. So one of the reasons I like interviewing pastors who write books is because I can usually tell that it's written out of a real felt need from the people in their congregation and based upon real conversations and struggles that people are really going through. Is that the case for you?
Well, yeah. Yeah, no question. Yeah, particularly with this this recent book that I wrote called The Dusty Ones, it actually was kind of birthed out of an experience that I had in the church of doing really what could amount to be one of the dumbest ideas ever, and that is I preached through the book of Numbers for 6 months straight. And I what we see here, this little love child, is the result of that preaching series. Personally, I'm one of those kind of old school folks who believes that theology that is not done in service of the church is a great form of idolatry. And I really do believe that theology should come out of lived experience and should come out of a group of people that are attempting to follow God together, be it an institutional group or just a small group, whatever, but just that it's done in community. And so, yes, the answer is 100% yes.
So I think that makes me wonder, you know, when several people are kind of dealing with the same thing, kind of what's going on in greater culture in the zeitgeist that prompts us all to ask the same question or go through the same crisis?
Well, I can certainly say that in my experience of the local church that I pastor, that people seem to go through things in seasons. And as a community, you know, for example, right now we're walking through a season of lament and grieving over a couple of family crises that really around children that really are heartbreaking. And so, you know, the community is asking a number of questions that relate to, you know, how do we find God in that? You know, in the summertime around here in Oregon, we don't get a lot of sun. So when we do, you know, we're asking a whole other series of questions. You know, where do we find God in celebration and joy? And so, yeah, I certainly think that God's people seem to go through seasons. And part of my role as a pastor and as a writer is to address those seasons, because the Christian faith is in no way, shape, or form stagnant. It evolves. It kind of goes through seasons, and it's our job to not only put one ear in the Bible, but one ear in among the community that we're called to love.
Can you think of a particular time in your life when you felt like you were wandering?
Yeah, I probably have more stories around wandering than I do just about anything else. I mean, I certainly have physical stories of wandering, of being lost. But as it relates to my walk with Christ, I can count, you know, a number of times in which it sensed that that I was in a season of wandering. One in particular was during my time in seminary when I was doing my master's degree work and to some degree my PhD work as well. I went through a season of really sort of pulling apart this faith that had been handed to me, kicking the tires, deconstructing. And when I went through that season of time, I think that wandering probably would be the one word that I would say that universally described it, and that I didn't know where I was going or what I was doing. And while I came out the other side and have kind of put back together this story of faith that God has given to me, I can 100% say that that was a wandering season. One of the things that I try to articulate in this book is this kind of fundamental idea that in the Bible, wandering is not all bad. I've been sort of handed this understanding, and many of us have, of this idea that wandering is essentially a bad thing. It's always bad. But when you read the Bible, it just doesn't hold up. Wandering often is something that God actually invites his people into. And one of the things I'm attempting to do in this book is give people a way of understanding what those wandering experiences are as divine gifts from God and how God can meet us in them.
So one of the things I found interesting was that you chose the word wandering, which you've used here, versus journey. And journey has been a really trendy word to describe Christianity. And I wonder if that's something that you were conscious of.
Yeah. Shane, you and I may share a critique of the word journey. While the word journey as a metaphor, as a central metaphor for faith, has great power in it, I do think that there are elements of faith that are like a journey. The problem with that metaphor for me is that when we see Christian faith as a journey, it can subconsciously or almost implicitly create within us this mindset that we are never going to arrive, that life is a journey and we never fully get there. And Christianity is not in any way, shape, or form a journey without an end. It has an end. We have a goal. Paul wouldn't have written in the book of Philippians to turn our eyes heavenward towards the prize to which we've been called. I mean, there's a sense of ending to our faith. There's a sense of culmination, a climax, as it were. And you know, that may come across, which is why wandering to me is an important, a very important metaphor, because we don't always wander. We go through seasons of wandering, but the goal is not wandering. Here in Portland, as an example, I find it very interesting that in a place like Portland, and I'm going to assume that this is true in many cities in America, it is exceptionally fine for somebody to be a spiritual mm-hmm. seeker, to look into something, to be a spiritual seeker. But the minute you become a spiritual finder, you're closed-minded, arrogant, and bigoted. And I think that that's hypocritical. I don't think that we're called to just wander forever. We're not called to just seek forever. I think we've been created by God to find. I think we've been created by God to actually arrive somewhere. And so journey to me can imply this idea that we're always on the journey, when in reality, I do think that we arrive at some point.
I heard a pastor a couple of years ago, and in fact, kind of a progressive pastor, I was impressed that he said this, that essentially the exact same thing that you said, that if you in culture to claim that you are seeking, you will receive high praise for that. But if you ever claim to find anything, those same people who gave you the praise might quickly turn on you.
Mm. Yeah, that's a mantra here in Portland. I mean, it's certainly an implicit mantra. It's not spoken, but there is this sense at which if you claim to have arrived in any spiritual capacity, you're arrogant. That becomes arrogance. And that to me is really, really quite silly. I don't know any other arena in the medical community. You never talk like that. You know, you never say like, well, you've, how dare you have medical knowledge, you arrogant, da, 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 da. I mean, you know, it's spirituality is the one place. And ultimately, I think it's because people have critiques of people like Christians. People struggle with people who claim to have arrived anywhere. And I can understand that critique. While I disagree with that, I can understand it.
And do you think that also comes from so often the people who are most certain about their beliefs have some of the most ugly beliefs?
That's a really good point. I mean, there can be a sense at which when one has all their ducks in a row, they can become quite arrogant. But in as much as that may be true, I think it's equally as problematic on the other side to not try and not look into the matter and just to write Jesus off because we've had a bad experience with a few Christians. I'm not going to stop reading the newspaper because there was an editorial a couple years ago that bugged me. giving on both sides, there can be a problem, and that is the arrogance of over-dogmatic thinking on one side and the arrogance of never entering in. Both of those are problematic.
Well, I think there's been so much written and so much ink spilled about doubt in Christianity being a good thing, and and which I agree with. I've had those people on this podcast. But I think there is the other side of that where we shame people as being like anti-intellectual for not having doubts all the time, or for, you know, feeling like they've nailed down one facet of who God is or something that they can trust about God.
Yeah. So what I hear you saying is that people are skeptical of other followers of Jesus if they're not in some kind of existential crisis.
Yeah, exactly.
Without question. I've often, in my own way of thinking about this, there's almost this unspoken hierarchy of who really gets it depending on who's experienced the most pain or not. What I call the scar wars. You know, like whoever has the biggest scar has the biggest voice. And what that does, frankly, is that celebrates suffering and says the only way to authenticity and truth is through suffering. I think it was Simone Weil who once said that if the minute you celebrate suffering, then you demand that somebody does it. And that's a really dangerous way of understanding truth, to say that one must have had some level of existential crises or suffering in order to understand. While we do validate those experiences, we don't need to demand them in order to be authentic followers of Jesus.
Well, I think too that a lot of times it's just flat out cynicism disguised as genuine doubt.
Yeah. Well, and if cynicism is probably the fastest growing denomination in America, isn't it? I mean, it's just hope is something that's very risky, and it often gets you in more trouble than it does anything else.
So you spend some time in the book talking about sin and the idea of boundaries. Two, you spend a lot of time discussing the Garden of Eden. One of the most fascinating things you said that I never realized was that in God's creation and the order of creation, that boundaries existed before sin. I wonder if you could just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I find these two tensions at play in our culture and in our world. I mean, we live in a sort of world of modalities, don't we, where we have these, and polarities, where we have these, you know, very differing, almost black and white things. You know, you've got either Bernie and Hillary or Trump, Cruz. You've got either you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, either you're an evangelical or you're a mainliner, either you're da 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 da. You sort of, you know, black and whites. And culturally speaking, I see often those played out in these two ways of understanding the world. And that is that there's on one side a side of kind of progressive culture that would say that we should be free to do whatever we choose to do. And then on the other side, kind of conservative culture, which says we are bounded by rules and laws, be they eternal or temporal. And this either we're free or we're bounded will tend to emphasize either one or the other. And ultimately, when I read the biblical text, particularly in Genesis 1 and 2, I find both of those tensions at play. I find, first of all, God, the very first commandment of God to Adam and Eve is in Genesis 2, at least. In Genesis 1, he says, be fruitful, multiply. But in Genesis 2, he says, eat. You're free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the one that's in the middle, the tree knowledge of good and evil. And in that one phrase, God simultaneously holds to both polarities. He says that you are invited to freedom. You are free to eat from anything, but there's a boundary. Don't eat within this. Don't eat from this tree. We're called ultimately what I call bounded creativity. We are called to a life of creativity with boundaries around it. It's like when we were kids and we were given something to draw within. You know, you color, but you always color within the lines. You're called to creativity, but that there are boundaries. And unfortunately, people either think it's one or the other, which is probably why Christians really struggle with progressive culture and progressive culture really struggles with evangelicals, is because, and many Christians, because they see the other as being the opposite of what they are. Our culture in Portland in particular yearns so desperately to be cage-free. When I say cage-free, that's a metaphor for something that we do with chickens.
Right.
But it's not just an image for chickens. Cage-free is a life. We desire a life free of boundaries. And the problem with a life free of boundaries is we'll actually get it. And when we get it, I think we're going to be really hurt by it. I think we'll be destroyed by it, actually. God has not invited us to just be free. God has not invited us to just be bounded. He's invited us to be bounded and creative at the same moment. Does that make sense?
It does. So I had, when I was reading that portion of the book, I had this memory of a long time ago, I went to a show for a band, and they'd written this song that came from someone daring them to write a song based on the tone of a cell phone ring. And it was like, so this was like the early 2000s. So there were like, you know, five annoying like MIDI files that were cell phone rings back then. And that song turned out to be like a really, like a decently like big hit for them. And I thought it's so interesting that they had this restraint that was given them. And out of that, like birthed this creation that was turned out to be much better than many times when they sat down at the table and had no restrictions on them, on their creativity.
Mm.
And I just thought it really impressed upon me, like that relationship of boundaries and restrictions being a partner, if you will, being complementary to creativity.
Yeah. Without question. I think about my son, my 4-year-old boy. I mean, the worst thing I can do to my son is to make his entire life a series of faithfulness to rules. I don't want him to just live a life of faithfulness to rules. I want my kid to be able to be creative. There's a wonderful little book by a Russian a scholar. There's a book called Creativity that was written a number of years ago. And this guy who started this, the study of creativity on an academic level. And he looks at some of the most brilliant creative people in the world. And he discovered that all of these people, these brilliantly creative individuals, were people who, when they were kids, had really distant parents who let them basically do whatever they wanted to do. they were not present parents at all. And what he discovered was not that parents should be distant or not care for their kids, but kids grow up into the most creative people in the world when they are given space as children to be allowed to make mistakes. And ultimately, in my story of following God, I see so much about that in my relationship with the Creator. There are laws, there are commandments, but there is also the sense of freedom, of creativity. And when I make a mistake, when I sin, when I do something God doesn't want me to do, I can always return to God's grace and be given a chance to try again. God is not a helicopter parent. Right? God does not breathe down our neck every single minute of every day, ensuring that we do everything perfectly, because we just won't. But he is with us. He is with us. But he also allows us to be free to make mistakes. So there's that tension, bounded creativity. There's a tension there.
You talk also about the idea of big S sin. I'm going to have to enunciate very well. Big S sin and little s sin. Well, I think most of us understand the idea of a sin that we mean something we do that's wrong, an action.
Mm.
But it's a little harder to grasp the idea of that, the state of being that I think you're referring to when you talked about the big S sin.
Yeah. So really kind of what I'm attempting to get at in that section of sin, in which I'm actually talking about why we wander. There are stories in the Bible around wandering where we wander because of sinfulness and because of our disobedience. But my argument would be that more often than not, that's not the case. It's not more often than not, wandering is a part of the journey that God, part of the plan that God actually has created for us to live into. But the difference really between big S sin and little s sin is this. Little s sins are the things that we do that don't align with who God is. They're decisions that we make. We've a little lie here. We steal a little bit of money from there. We sleep around on a couple Friday nights and da da da. I mean, we could go on and on and on. But ultimately, to me, those are not the things that the Bible takes the greatest issue with. Big S sin is what I think the Bible takes its greatest issue with, and that is separation from God. Separation from God and not being in an ongoing communion with the Creator. And I think small S sin is actually a byproduct of big S sin. It's not the other way around. Meaning when I do those things, I steal, I'm greedy, I don't care for the poor, I give my body away to other people in sexual acts that I know are not good for me or good for others. When I do that, that is a byproduct of being alienated in my own mind from the Creator. And I think that's the fundamental thing that the Bible takes issue at correcting, and that is creating an opportunity and a context for us to know God once again. In my church, we had a story of a young boy who he was 12, 13 years old. I mean, it's kid, just a little kid, and he may have actually been a little bit younger than that. I think he was more like 9 years old, and he was 9 years old, and he started growing a beard.
Yeah, nine is what you said in the book. Yeah,
I think he was nine. Although he's 13, 14 now, but he's 9 years old. He started growing a beard. He started getting BO. I mean, 9 year old kids don't get BO. They don't start growing a beard. And the family didn't know what to do with it. And so they took him to the doctor. It turns out this little boy, had a massive pituitary gland on a massive tumor on his pituitary gland. And, the boy got it taken out and he was fine. But when we think about sin in that context, you know, his BO, his growing the beard, was a byproduct. It was a symptom of the disease. It wasn't the disease itself. They didn't need to give him deodorant. They didn't need to give him a razor.
Right.
They needed to take the tumor out of his head. And the same is true with sin. We spend all of our time railing on small s sins, cussing, lying, greed. And those are things we need to stop doing. But those are symptoms of the real disease. And the real disease is that we're not in communion with God.
You know, you mentioned deconstruction earlier, which I think is like what sends a lot of people into wandering. And it seems like most of the people I know who've gone through deconstruction, either it does make them better, it does deepen their faith, as the subtitle of your book says, or it makes them more cynical. Often I see that it makes people prideful, because there's kind of this narcissistic, like, I'm the only one who gets it, who understands how dark the world really is. And I wonder what you would say is the difference in what makes one person respond one way and one the other. Which is, let me just say, that is essentially a huge question, because that's kind of what your entire book is about.
Yep. Yeah, you know, man... a lot of probably my reflections on that would come out of my own experience. But I have often reflected on this little book by a guy. It was an old German Protestant theologian named Helmut Thielke, who wrote a book called A Little Book for Seminarians or something. A book for young seminarians or young theologians. And in the book, he actually is addressing what happens when somebody goes to seminary, when somebody kind of goes through a season of deconstruction. And that is that, you know, you go to seminary and you learn all these concepts and you learn all of these ideas and you learn all of these thoughts and you learn about the word ontology and perichoretic and Trinitarian mutuality. And you're given these words that, you know, are really cool and sexy and make you sound really smart among other Christians. And what Helmut Thielke discovered was that seminarians were coming in loving Jesus and loving the church and leaving questioning Jesus and hating the church. And he wrote a book for them to try to help them understand how they could leave seminary and leave that experience positively. And he says ultimately that there are two kinds of theologians. There's the theologian who takes the knowledge that they've received and they go and they do it, and they become people who use knowledge to serve other people. They don't go and get knowledge to get prideful. They take their knowledge to serve God's people and serve the church. And he calls those people theologians of love. And he says, but there's another kind of theologian, and this is the theologian who gains ideas and Greek words, and they get all the right ideas and whatnot, and they use those ideas to manipulate and control in a power trip other Christians in the church. And he calls those diabolical theologians, theologians of the devil. And and ultimately what he's attempting to articulate, I think he answers your question, and that is, do we love or do we not? More often than not, in my own experience, Shane, people that go through the seminary experience or go through a deconstruction period, it's not as though they aren't learning. They're learning, and they learn a lot of big words and a lot of important ideas. But more often than not, those ideas are not used to serve and love other people. They're used to gain power and control. And I think that is either knowledge is going to puff up, or love is going to edify. And as long as we are doing things to gain power and control and authority and to gain a platform, we're on the wrong track.
You tell a really powerful story in, I think it's the 7th chapter, about coming up on a car accident and being the first one to see it. I wonder if you'd tell that story and then open up the way that relates to wandering.
Well, yeah, I'll kind of tell how it relates to wandering first, and then I'll tell this story. And it is a very powerful story, one that I hold very near and dear to my heart. One of the things that I see in the wandering stories in the Bible is that God is still very close to his people. In the wandering story of Israel, Israel is wandering through the desert. And what does God do? He comes to him by fire at night and cloud by day. God comes to them all the time. He's with them all the time. Wandering is not the absence of God. God wanders with his people. God is with his people. And the same sort of thing plays itself out in the life of Jesus. I was listening to a New Testament scholar who said that when you look at the stories of Jesus, 90% of the stories in Jesus' life and ministry, 90% of the stuff that he taught as they were walking somewhere, as they were wandering somewhere, as they were going somewhere. And as Jesus walked around and he wandered around and he did what he did, Jesus was always touching people. He was always touching people. He was very touchy-feely, probably a little too extroverted for most of our comforts. Jesus touched a lot. He was very touchy-feely. And so both of those, to me, play themselves out, and that is that God is near his people. Even in times of wandering, God is so close. And I think at the end of the day, one of our fundamental needs as human beings, one of our fundamental needs is we need to be touched. We need to be touched. A baby will not survive its first year of life if it's not touched. It will die. In the first few months, it'll die. It will literally just die. We were created by God to be touched. I tell a story in the book about coming across a car crash here in Oregon. It was 10 o'clock at night. I was driving home from teaching a class, and this truck was wrapped around a big metal beam. And nobody was there. It was just me. I saw it. Went up to the truck. I had no idea if anybody was going to be alive in this thing. I thought maybe a family would be dead. And I come up to this truck, and there's a man in there, and he was in the front seat and mangled in this mess of metal. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. And he looks up at me, and he says, "Help! I want out." And I go to reach for my phone, and of course, my phone was dead from a day of work. My phone was dead. I couldn't call anybody, which at the end of the day was God's grace, because somebody else had pulled up and started calling 911. So it was God's grace, because I just got to be there with this guy. It was just me and him, and I wasn't on the phone. I just got to be with him. And I climbed up on the truck as best as I could, and I just put my hand down into the truck, and I put my hand on his shoulder, and I prayed with him, and I just I was present with him. And the minute I put my hand on his shoulder, I felt his body just go like at peace. He wasn't alone. He knew he wasn't alone. I just touched him and he was at peace. And the ambulance came. They said, get off the truck. I did. And I watched for a good hour and a half, 2 hours as they used the jaws of life and they got him out. And his life was saved. I think he was in the hospital for about a month and a half, month and a half. And I tell that story for one simple reason, and that is that that story is precisely why I am a Christian. I am a Christian because I was unable, in the story of my own life, when I was 16 years old and became a Christian, I was unable to fix my own life or get out of the truck of my own broken life. And the way God's economy works is that God does not demand that we get out of the wreck of our lives in order to be touched. He actually touches us within it. And that is, for me, the fundamental message of the gospel. It's the message of God's presence among his people in the wandering stories. And that is that we may be a complete wreck, but God always in Jesus puts his hand through the wreck of our lives and touches us and fulfills the one need that he has created us to have.
I think that that's such a potent visual, and especially for those of us who grew up with a picture of God and with, you know, bridge illustrations of us being divided from God and we're required to, you know, walk across the cross to get to God. When the real story of the gospel is that God coming over to our side, God invading our space. And so when we're wandering, even if we are trying to wander away from God, that we have him with his hand on our shoulder during that time.
Yep. Yeah. It would be in my mind, it's actually a perversion of the gospel to create that bridge and say, we have to walk to God. And that is the complete opposite of the narrative of God in the gospels and in the New Testament. And that is that God is, as my friend Amos Young, who's a theologian, speaks of, the condescension of God. God always condescends to our level. He condescends himself to be on our level. And to create a gospel that's anything different than that is to cause it to not be the gospel at all.
Well, AJ, I just so much enjoyed reading the book and this conversation that we've been able to have. Thanks for doing
it. Shane, thanks for having a wonderful podcast and doing the service that you do for the church and God's people. Thanks for the work that you do.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SEMINARYDROPOUT, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,